I bootstrap. I don't have funding. So I bootstrap this baby. And that is petrifying. And you hear people say, never spend your own money. Listen, I'm spending my own money. This is where I am. And if this didn't come to what I think it's going to, I'm thrilled out of my mind that I did this. This sounds really horrible, probably, but I can die now. I have zero regret. My best advice is if you think that you can, do it. If you think that you can do it, be aware you're jumping in. You're jumping off a cliff. You're going to be tested like you've never been tested. And you're going to be so happy you did. I have no regret.
This can't be it. There has to be more. Wait, am I crazy? No. If you're yearning for more and working hard to make your dreams a reality, then you're in the right place. Welcome to Dreamcatchers. It's the only show committed to helping you self-actualize and then transcend, leaving you with the legacy you've always desired. Listen in on conversations with successful philanthropists, entrepreneurs, and founders every week as we connect with them for inspiration, education, and direction. Your host, Jerome Myers, is here to help you exit the matrix and transform into a leader of your own revolution. The question is, do you believe your dreams should be real? Hey, everybody, and welcome to the Dreamcatchers podcast. I am your host, Jerome, and I have Jessica Preston with me today. And based on the conversation that we had before I hit the record button, you all are in for a treat. Jessica, how are things in your neck of the woods? Where are you on this fabulous day?
I'm in Michigan. I'm in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Just finished the eclipse watching. So that's what our day is today.
Such a cool phenomenon and a rare one. I think there's only been one of this magnitude in a long, long time, like the 70s was the last one or something like that. So, all right, I open up the show. You told me no, we want to ask you this before, but I think we actually got to answer. So you had an exit.
Yes. And from your description, yes.
Mm-hmm. So for those of you out there who haven't heard about the 8 exits of a founder, it goes everywhere from leaving corporate or being an employee to leaving being chief everything officer to leaving being a thought leader or a product manager to becoming a true CEO to exiting the company and being on the board to selling the company, from selling the company to building your post-exit portfolio, and from your post-exit portfolio to building a fully endowed philanthropic foundation. And so oftentimes people feel like they haven't had an exit because they just think about selling their business. And if you listen to the continuum, that's not until exit number 6. There's a whole lot of things that have to happen before you have an exit. There's a tremendous amount of evolving that goes on along the way. And not only evolving, but in some instances, transformation, complete and total transformation. And what's really cool about Jessica is I believe that she is deep into that transformation. And while still on that journey, I think she'll be able to unpack some great lessons for us on this journey. And so, Jessica, let's talk a little bit about your exit, because you left corporate and you started doing your own thing.
Yes, I did. I did.
So how'd you know
that you could do it?
Because you've been doing it for a while now, right? I think a lot of people struggle with the thought of not being an employee anymore after they've built a successful career. And in your case, you were an executive at a company that was doing really well.
Yeah, so it was quite a transition. So first I was in medicine for 20 years in a clinic space. And so that's really looking at an individual on an individual level and not in a corporate scaling space. But what I was finding in that space of medicine was I wasn't helping as many people as I wanted to, but I didn't really understand scaling. And I was very fortunate that a laboratory came in and basically offered me a VP of medical affairs position in a growing laboratory here in Michigan. So I had the opportunity to work with a group of executives and employees that were really about scaling and how do we make this grow and expand. And so I really got to put my lens on that. When we're looking in medicine, we're looking at the individual. When we're looking at laboratory or a hospital system or something larger, we're looking with a larger lens, more of a utilitarian, greatest good for the greatest many. It was a perfect, perfect way to learn that, yes, I can do this and expand. And I was in charge of educating medical providers about the testing we had, educating them about the science behind it, And then we were talking so much about my love, which is infertility and helping people conceive naturally with a functional medicine approach. So that's where I started. And then I saw, and I knew that I really felt that that was a gift to me. It was given to me to be able to see this is how I'm going to get there. Because when I was in medicine, I said, I need to find a way to get there. And a lab came in and said, here's how, without knowing. And so I kept building upon that. And then what happened is, after I was there for about 3 years, I was doing a lot of work in this field of the laboratory, which was molecular testing and genetics testing. And I felt like I was off my aim for my vision and mission to help people conceive naturally, because our fertility, as I told you, for infertility is 1 in 5 couples trying to conceive cannot at this point in time. So the number is very high. And so I really felt compelled to find a way to get in that space. And that's where I was trying to figure out how am I going to get out of this lab space.
Whoa, you said big words. And so, for the folks out there, you said functional medicine and infertility. And I think most adults who have children or wanted to have children understand infertility. It's the inability to get pregnant. But then you threw in the functional medicine approach. And I don't think functional medicine is as common as maybe many of us would like for it to be. So, how does functional medicine intertwine with infertility?
Right, thank you. So when we look at infertility, 49% of infertility is subclinical, meaning we don't have a diagnosis. The levels of our lab testing isn't quite enough to say that you have PCOS or another issue that might be a cause of infertility. So that's really where we look, but we also look at those PCOS, endometriosis. Male factor infertility now is up to 40% of infertility has a male factor component. And so that's sperm, testosterone being low, sperm count being low, the way the sperm swims, the shape of the heads, tails, all of that is implicit in infertility. So when we look at functional medicine, we're looking at why do we have this? So functional medicine is asking the question, why do we have this medical issue, whether it's infertility or anything, as opposed to what is the diagnosis? So conventional medicine is, what is your diagnosis? It's infertility. What do we do to treat it? We try with IVF, which works less than 30% of the time at a large expense, and it's bypassing the underlying issues by basically giving you extra hormones to make more eggs to be able to have a retrieval done and then inseminate with the sperm outside of the body. Now, I'm not saying we work with IVF, so there's nothing wrong with IVF, but it's less, it can take 3 to 6 cycles for you to conceive at $15,000 to $30,000 a pop. And so the expense is really high. And we just found a study from November of 2023 said those of us with subfertility, that's me, I had infertility issues. Those of us with subfertility have a slight increased risk of autism in our babies. And we don't want that either. And so what I would love to see is more partnering with IVF, with convention, to be able to optimize that sperm and egg health. So back to functional medicine. What we're looking at is the why are we here? Why is the sperm count lower? So let's look at that for an example for male factor. So if our sperm count is lower or there is a problem with semen analysis, it can frequently be related to a low testosterone. Low testosterone can be related to things like stress, poor sleep, poor diet. So what we do in functional medicine, so we look at what those components are. We may do some testing and we may not, and then we treat the why. So we will take an individual or a couple, and we will help them optimize those factors to be able to boost up your testosterone, to boost up sperm count, motility, morphology. So that's an example. It's simplified. It's not quite that simple, but it is where we look at the underlying root cause of what's going on and try to correct it at that level. Then what makes us a little unique is we don't only do functional medicine, we partner with conventional medicine so that you have the best of all worlds. All worlds. So we optimize what we can. And then if we need to also incorporate conventional medicine, we will.
Whoa. So why? Oh boy, here we go. So why do
Okay.
you think that we skip over actually treating the root cause? And try to skip to, we're just going to inseminate an egg and put it back in and hope everything works out.
Sure. So it's a different philosophy of medicine. So conventional medicine, when I went into medicine and learning medicine, it's what's called a reductionistic model. We take one factor, and what we do is we reverse engineer it to the point of we think this is the cause. So let's use heart disease, for example. Heart disease, we looked at, and I'm simplifying this as well. We looked at what factor causes heart disease. We reverse engineer it and look at cholesterol. So then we say what number of people had what level of cholesterol that is elevated that is correlated with heart disease. And then we give you a statin so that we can bring that level down so we can decrease your risk of heart disease. Do you see how that is? So that's a what is wrong? Get the cholesterol level. How do we treat it? Give the statin. Okay, so if we're looking at it from a functional medicine lens, it's a different philosophy and it looks more at the biochemistry or systems biology approach of a body as to why is that cholesterol high in the first place. Okay, and so then frequently it can be intervention with diet. But the other thing is, we're saying just cholesterol, but remember the first thing we mentioned was heart disease. What is actually the cause of heart disease? Combination. Inflammation, number one, genetics. Yes, cholesterol, but it's multifactorial. So we look at it through a lens of holism, which is looking at multiple factors at once. So the word holistic, like holistic medicine. So when people hear holistic medicine, I think they think woo-woo a lot, as opposed to holism, which is looking at so many individual factors put together. And then we're trying to say, where is that in an individual? So this very individualized medicine, where is it with that individual? How can we intervene on that root cause and find it from that one person and give them the tools they need to make change? So when it comes to conventional medicine, everything is evidence-based. We actually are evidence-based in our program as well. Everything, we have evidence behind us for what we do. But in conventional medicine, there are levels of evidence when it comes to treatment. So we have to have a certain level of evidence when somebody presents with a certain issue and diagnosis in order for us to treat. And that's how medicine has become in conventional medicine. It's become quite algorithmic. So it's the way that conventional medicine has gone. And when you look at root cause medicine, because you can't take one factor and reduce it down, then holism doesn't have the same level of evidence as reductionism does in the conventional medicine space, and it's more widely accepted in this country. It is what we do, it's where we have our evidence. Now, the American Academy of Family Physicians in 2017, I believe, I know there was an original in 2004, they changed the definition of evidence-based to include, yes, the greatest evidence that we can find out in study, but also our clinical expertise and the wishes and desires of the individual. Because if you have somebody who arrives in your medical practice and they don't actually want to take a statin, or they did and they had muscle aches, but that's something that your provider says you need to do, now we're not taking their wishes or and desires into play. And there are a lot of religious exceptions when it comes to treatments that, like, think about blood transfusions. So in some cases, we say we recommend a blood transfusion, but if a patient has a religious objection or even a personal objection to a blood transfusion, then they should have that option to be able to not do that. So now the American Academy of Family Physicians, and that's a conventional medicine body of people and legislature that basically says we can actually consider our clinical expertise and your desire as a patient. So we're getting there. We're getting there. And that's where I find really with functional medicine and conventional medicine, as long as we are on the same page of healing and wellness for our patients, then we can actually connect and have better communication on how we can be a better team to serve our patients and be their advocates.
I don't often hear many people saying, especially medical providers, that they want to be advocates for their patients. I think they just want their patients to comply so they can move on. Where did that approach come from for you?
Oh, so much. Oh, that's a beautiful question. Thank you for that. First, let me say, those of us have been in conventional medicine as well, the pressure on us to see a patient in 10 minutes to get it right. And so understand what a conventional medicine provider or any provider must do. We have to hear a patient, understand what they're presenting with. We have to collect all of those symptoms and be an excellent diagnostician. We have to get testing done to confirm our suspicions for a diagnosis. Then we have to convince the patient of the diagnosis because a lot of people are in denial. So we have to find a, we have a good bedside manner to be able to say, this is what's going on with you. Then we have to get their buy-in for treatment. And then they leave our office and they still have to comply. So that is the complexity of a medical provider. Okay, so we have, and that's why a lot of us that are really passionate about making sure we get buy-in from our patient, because compliance from a patient is the best indicator when it comes to getting their buy-in. If you're not believing what I'm saying, then you're going to leave and you're not going to do anything that I ask of you. I have to have you really understand what this is for you. So I take a lot of time with patients, well more than 10 minutes. When we are constrained and confined by a 10-minute window or 15-minute, maybe 20 minutes max to have all of that done for a patient, it's near impossible for the conventional medicine system to actually help a patient become compliant by being your advocate. So I was seeing 30 to 40 patients a day at times. I would run late. People would complain. I still ran late. I had a reputation of running late, but everybody knew. My patients knew that if you were seeing me, it was worth the wait because I'm giving you just as much time as I gave the person before you. So my family didn't appreciate it, but my patients sure did. But it really did become that space of how do I help more people? Because there aren't a lot of providers out there who have the luxury of doing that. I had the luxury of doing that because I was in a private practice. Most clinicians are not in a private practice. You're owned by a hospital system, and so your hands are tied. And a lot of people just burn out and do the best they can. But the flip side of that also is patients are sicker than they've ever been before. And so now patients come in and want you to just know and fix it. And we're in a hurry, and we didn't have lunch. We didn't get to pee since we left the house at 6 a.m. and it's 2 o'clock in the afternoon. We're trying to catch up, keep up, and hold space for the person in front of us. So we really need to work harder on that. So that's the plug for conventional medicine. We're trying. Everybody is trying, but I've always been a patient advocate. And when I walk in a patient door and I close that door, I'm only with that patient and I have no thought of who else is on the other side of that door. I've compartmentalized incredibly well and I'm very, very gifted with that. So I'm very happy with that. So I'm not leaving until I either have your buy-in, or if I know it's going to take us another half hour, I'm going to have you come back and see me next week. Or if I know that you need to have some time to accept this diagnosis, which sometimes I would give hard news. So you give hard news in a 10-minute window, that's hard. Go home, think about it, come and see me next week, get them on my schedule next week, and we're going to have another conversation. And maybe, and frequently I would put them at the end of my day so that I could stay late and give them the time that they needed for something like that. So that's how.
All right. So you were breaking the rules
Oh, I
before you
broke the
started
rules
doing your
all
own.
over, but that's, I am a rule breaker. I've always been a rule breaker. Ask my mom. I've always been a rule breaker. Everybody should have known. If you know me.
So you're breaking the rules. At some point, I think we become unemployable. What was the indication for you that being an employee was no more for you? You should do the thing.
Yeah, from clinic before laboratory, I was just honestly in prayer and meditation trying to figure out how I could help more people because infertility was my thing at that point. And what I was really trying to ask for is I did the math. I was only helping 13 more people per month, and that's not enough. And to be able to have them at the end of my days and help teach them what they needed to do for their systems. And so that's when the lab came along and just asked me to come. Like it wasn't a, I didn't look for a job. It was fated as far as I'm concerned. I felt like it was an answer to prayer. And so when I went into that space, it was beautiful. Once I expanded in that space to learn how to educate, and some wonderful leaders in that space who really helped guide me on where they wanted me to go. And once again, I do break rules and I don't have a lot of fear. So when I walk in a room, I can figure it out and then see how am I going to serve you? Very important. How am I going to serve you? How am I going to get us where we need to go? I had the luxury of not, I wasn't sales. I didn't have to sell anything. I just got to go in and talk about all the things that are going to make your patients' lives better and therefore your lives better. It was wonderful. But after 3 years of that, even less, after about 2 years of that, I felt that I wasn't doing fertility. And I was really feeling that tug of, what am I going to do? How am I going to get out of this? And so it took me about a year. And then what I did is I went to Costa Rica for a week-long retreat. And it was a deep in meditation space. And I came back from that knowing I had to get out. And I was making a very nice salary. And I basically said to myself, I don't know how to get out of this. And a good friend of mine said at work, said, put together a business plan. We're going to put it in front of some people I know and we'll get you funding. And I started researching business plans and I went, I can't just do that. That doesn't make sense to me at all. I'd never done anything like it before. But I go all in when I go in. So I just started learning about it. And another friend of mine said, there's an incubator program here in town. I'm in Ann Arbor, Michigan. It's Spark through, and they're connected with SBDC. And so I signed up for their incubator program while I was still working at the lab, not knowing how I was going to be able to do it. I had no idea. And I knew it was like all day on Tuesdays. And I did have flexibility with my schedule, but I was also their MSL, medical science liaison. I answered questions all the time. You always could reach me. Everybody had my cell phone. I was day and night. It didn't bother me. I loved it, but I didn't know how I was going to do it. So what ended up happening is what, I don't know, it was right before, it was about a week before my incubator was about to start. Basically, the owner of the company cleaned house, got rid of a whole bunch of us executives all at one time. And it was the best gift I ever could have received. Because at that point in time now, I see I'm telling on myself because now if people listen to this that I worked with, I could have won an Oscar for that performance because I was not sad. I felt like I was given a gift because I also had a severance package so I could actually work on my business while I was leaving that space. Wasn't a long severance package, but it was enough to give me enough encouragement to get out there and launch. So there was my exit.
Yeah, what's beautiful about the severance package? I always talk about making sure that you don't run out of runway. I think a new enterprise is like the airplane on the tarmac trying to get off the ground. And as long as you have money, the plane doesn't have to take off. But if you get to the end of the runway and you don't take off, it's crash, burn, disaster, all kinds of things. And so what extended your runway was the fact that you probably had some savings, but you had the income from the severance package to allow you to get through the path. And so, but the person said that if you made a business plan or entered an incubator program, they'd get you funding. So, did you get funded?
No, so that was somebody that I worked with, and it was a different avenue. He was saying, put a business plan together. And I looked at it, looked at hiring help for it. But the truth is, when you're starting a business, don't have someone else make your business plan because it's your business. You need to be completely 100% in the know of everything. And that in itself is scary. You have to look at things. I was not finance. I was not business. I wasn't any part of any of this. So I was very lucky. I had my severance. And then I ended up in this program. It's through Spark. I did their boot camp and then I did their biotech program. Then I did their fast pace. And then they had a competition and I won their best of boot camp. So I won some funding there. So the other funding aspect was gone at this point in time because it wasn't realistic. It was a very, very, very kind offer from someone who cares about me deeply. Thank you very much. I appreciate that confidence in me, but it's not how the world really works. So this is the direction that I ended up going, and it got us some attention. And I do still work with Spark's been wonderful. I have an entrepreneur in residence. I have people through SBDC that I work with that have been helping me out still. And so they help me with each step and milestones and the parts that I'm still learning about.
Man, this is a master class because you said the word, that's not how the world, well, I guess it wasn't a word, it was a sentence. That's not how the world really works. And it's fascinating to me how many people think that they're going to get funded without proof of concept. How
Yeah.
many people think they're going to get funded without customers or contracts? I laugh when people say, oh, just go get a loan from the bank. And you can get a personal loan. Or you can take credit cards and use them from a cash advance standpoint. But The bank doesn't invest in dreams. They invest in proven operators with business plans that they've seen work in the past.
Right.
And if you're going to launch something, you've got to figure out how to make it pay so that you can keep going. And I also watch people go into this passion stuff when they haven't actually become financially independent or work optional. And then they question whether or not they should charge people for this stuff because they don't feel like they've earned it or they're worthy or that they deserve to be compensated because they haven't helped 3 million people yet. And it just baffles me because the missionary without any money doesn't reach many people. So if we can, let's sit in this a little bit. So when you're chief everything officer, there's a point where things get tough. I remember running out of cash early in entrepreneurship. And I think cash management is something that is so important. And it's one of those things where it'll make you reconsider your decision. As an executive, you were probably making six figures. And so when that $10,000 plus hits the account every month, it feels good. But what happens when there isn't any money coming in or it's a fraction of what it used to be? Did you have any of those moments where you questioned what you were doing or why you were doing it or if you could keep going or if what I used to say on my walking meditation is my gifts will create room for me to continue the mission? But was there ever a point where you questioned whether or not you would be able to keep going?
Oh, absolutely. I think I still do. I know I still do. Right now I'm feeling wonderful. We've had a lot of great opportunities and a lot of wonderful people showing up asking for we're just branching out in a lot of different ways right now that we didn't even consider. So concept-wise, we're just blossoming right now and we've only been around for 2 years. So it's not terrible, but yes, without a doubt, maybe we'll run out. Maybe we will someday. I don't think so, but there's always a possibility. And that I have a good friend who's a finance person who keeps saying, when is the end of that runway? Like, when is shutdown day? And I've named it 5 times. I've named it 5 times. Like, we're out of money on this day. And then we end up not being out of money because we sell more, we do more, we expand more. And it's been amazing that it keeps extending. And I've been surprised over and over again. And I anticipate at this point, I've learned enough in that chief everything officer space that I don't have as many invisible fears, right? I don't know what that means if money runs out, where, why, what could we do? I don't have as much of that anymore, which is great. But I will tell you, I did. I invested a lot. I bootstrapped. I don't have funding. So I bootstrapped this baby. And that is petrifying. And you hear people say, never spend your own money. Never spend your own money. Listen, I'm spending my own money. This is where I am. And if this didn't come to what I think it's going to, I'm thrilled out of my mind that I did this. This sounds really horrible, probably, but I can die now. I have zero regret. My best advice is if you think that you can, do it. If you think that you can do it, be aware you're jumping in, you're jumping off a cliff, you're going to be tested like you've never been tested. And you're going to be so happy you did. I have no regret.
You said it with such conviction. I love it. I love it. I love it. I love it. So you said it sounds bad. It doesn't. The people who say don't ever use your money, they're either not done it because everybody who's done it has used some of their money at some point, or they're really advanced and they've learned how to use other people's money because they've got a track record of tremendous success. That is the only way that it works. It's almost very similar to the people who are like, oh, you can buy real estate with no money down. That's a sophisticated investor technique. It's not one for the people who don't have any money. And the crazy part is, you better have some money when you own the real estate, because if you own the real estate and you don't have any money, you're very likely to lose the real estate. Skip all of that. Get off my soapbox. What you're describing is the true essence of entrepreneurship. You don't need funding to figure out if it's going to work, because if you build a business model that allows you to be profitable or at least cash flow neutral from the beginning, then you keep yourself in a great place and you don't have to give up equity. You don't have to create burden on the project or the enterprise that's unnecessary when you're early in the process. That's kind of like, if we go back to the airplane analogy, putting a bunch of bricks in the back of the plane and then saying, I'm going to take off with it. Like, why would you do that? And so figuring out how to be lean, being resourceful, and then accessing the resources that are available to you is the thing that I think builds an enterprise that's going to make you understand what is and isn't ready for market. Now, there may come a point later where you need capital to build infrastructure that you couldn't build otherwise, or to acquire customers faster than you would organically. But that's a very different approach from just burdening the business with debt. One of the other things that you said that I really appreciate, and it goes back to the same concept of you put your own money in. And so if you lose it, you feel good because it's yours. You're not negatively impacting other people. All the risk is on me. And that for me is an indicator of a person who should be in entrepreneurship. I watch people who are going to raise money and then they don't believe other people's money is more valuable than their money. And it bothers me. Because there's a lot of folks who want to invest, but they've chosen not to because they've been burnt in the past. I put my money in this thing. I didn't really understand what the thing was. I trusted the person, even though they didn't really know what they were doing. And then they lost my money. And then they just shrugged their shoulders because they didn't feel like they owed me to pay me back. And so we have all of this capital sitting on the sideline. Or they're only willing to put it in the stock market because it's regulated by the SEC, whatever the thing is. I just wish that those interactions wouldn't happen because if they didn't happen, then it would be a whole lot easier for folks like you, me, and the other entrepreneurs out there who are bootstrapping it to get access to that growth capital. Now, whether it's as debt or equity is not as important, but what is important is that people aren't getting burned by folks who don't value the dollars that are being put into their enterprises. And when I watch, like when I think about it, like so many of us trade our time for money. And so, if you take a $10,000 investment or a $50,000 investment, for some people, that's a really long time in their life that it took them to accumulate that capital. And the thought that it's not valuable is like saying the time that they spent earning it isn't valuable. And for me, that's very disappointing. So, kudos to you for your approach. And I think in the long run, it's going to pay off for you. So, you've been. Well, it's not just you anymore, right? You said you were on the
Well,
chief everything officer journey, but you've got some team now. How about that?
I
Let's talk about
do.
that a little. A lot of people want to unlock their ultimate potential, but lack the strategy, support, and stamina necessary to achieve their major goals. They often try to overcome these challenges by trying to do it on their own, causing frustration, fatigue, and eventually failure. We have developed a model for a center life, aka the red pill, to help them bolster their beliefs, gain clarity on their path to success, and provide accountability as they take action on their goals. When they take the red pill, they rapidly accelerate attainment of their goals and begin to experience a life of significance and impact. Want to find out more? Hop over to JeromeMyers.co. Now, let's get back to the episode.
Yes, I have an amazing team, and I have so our approach with that functional medicine aspect is we have coaches, but I have eight coaches, and what we do is we teach men and women all about lifestyle, but we do a couples approach because if you just have the wife cooking dinner at home, I'm going to go with traditional role just for a minute. Wife cooking dinner at home, but the husband doesn't like it or understand that that's going to help him benefit his body as well as benefiting hers. Maybe he buys McDonald's on the way home and they're not on the same page. And at the core of our program is nervous system regulation. And so we take you out of fight or flight and we get you into a peaceful space so you can make change. We need to be in that space so we can make change. And then we do it as a couples program. So I have five women and three men, all th and what we do is we do a half hour education Then we split into mom and dad's groups. We call you mom and dad from day one because we want to break down those baby blocks and make sure you're accepting that. And all three men that we have are all trained in Mankind Project. So it's all men doing men's work. So they can hold space well for men. When there's a male factor for fertility, it's very emasculating and it can really hit a man deeply. They don't necessarily want to open up to women. The men that we have, two out of our three men in our program had fertility issues themselves. And so they speak very knowledgeably about this and they hold space very well. And then we have five women that also do the same for the moms. And everybody has, I have a functional medicine coach, I have a nutritionist, I have a heart math and hypnotherapy specialist, I've got a somatic life coach, I've got, who am I missing? I've got, and then my three men are all coaches in their own right. One of them is a social worker. And he also is knowledgeable in IFS, internal family systems, which is really valuable work as well. And so basically, that whole team gets together, and I built our team the same way I want us to hold space for our people we take care of, for our couples we take care of. So we all did the nutrition. Everybody did heart math and got a nervous system regulation. We did a team building hypnotherapy so that we could break down any, so we could have the optimal, ideal working environment. So my team is very much a family. Everybody is together and we meet once a week on Fridays for our team meetings. And we ex just extended the amount of time for our team meetings so we could actually do check-ins. And our check-ins are incredibly vulnerable about our own lives. We are holding space for each other. We do that for each other just as well as we do it for our clients, to the point we're practically mind reading with each other. And that's so very valuable because then when we have clients show up who are so much in need, we're continuity. We're one circle of people that is surrounding that entire group. Sometimes all of us show up, sometimes three of us show up. It depends on what that week's program is, but we are all present for that.
So this is a thing that I've been pondering lately, and I think you have unique insight into it. Why you said the men don't want to open up to the women. I think it goes both ways. I think there are women that don't want to open up to the men. Why is there that barrier? Why aren't we able to be vulnerable with the opposite sex about the thing that we're struggling with?
I think we can, but I think the way that we're doing this for our community, where we have men in one group and women in another, is in a certain, it's a methodology. So men doing men's work. So it's men basically knowledgeable and having done the work that we as women don't understand. So we do a lot of masculine, feminine dynamic work. So we talk about our true essence internally, whether we're more masculine or more feminine. Now, interestingly, are a lot of women that are in this boat, their ages 35 to 45, are very much in their masculine because we've been very powerful women and we don't like fall into that space of love and joy and peace and everything. So we, all of us in our women's group, we've done work in our masculine and feminine. I was truly in my masculine until probably about 5 years ago when I found I needed to be in my feminine for my personal world, brought that into my professional world, and found just such a lovely gestalt and mix of the two. But it's work, and man, is it work. You have to be vulnerable and you have to be authentic, and you have to look at yourself with a certain lens that can be hard. And so we have done that as women. So we see that in the women we serve. We see where they are. And we're like, oh, we automatically know because we've done that same work where we need to guide them and lead them. Whereas men do that for the men really, really well. And the verbiage for the men's group, we love. And then what we do after a while, we will take a week and we'll swap. And we'll have the men lead the women and the women lead the men so that we can each have the experience with the other. Because it's so, we think the five of us that are women and that lead in our group, we just love the way that the men that lead our program do it. And we love it in our team meetings. Like we ask one of them, please just walk us through that. Walk us through, because it's very systematic in a very masculine way. And it's so, it's more regimented, systematic, logical, more masculine minded. And so they have their own way of being able to help men write themselves and then listen to themselves and also be heard. Because a lot of, I'm sure that this makes sense to you, a lot of your audience. What has happened now for men is we've asked men to become women. We don't want men We're going everywhere today, aren't we? So we've asked men to be vulnerable and but still be strong. Cry, but don't cry. Hold space for me. Please be that strength for me, please. And that's what we want. We want that masculine and that masculine container. Masculinity is about holding strength for your family, silently, stoically. That's really what we want, because then we, as the feminine, can fall into that space so beautifully. We can surrender. But what has happened is we're asking men to not be that solid container. So women cannot surrender into it. So it's we're holding ourselves up in our masculine, legs trembling, because we can't hold that tight, right? Because it's not part of our essence. We want to be able to surrender to that space, but we have to trust the men that are holding us to be able to hold us in that space. The men that we have teaching this help men be vulnerable and find that space. And it's not buck up. It's not buck up. Let's go. It's not militant. It's we see you. We hear you. Let's help you. We understand you. Men too need to be seen. So that is what's happening in our men's group. And we in the women's group help women see their men. So we do the same. So we have a certain methodology to help community by helping a couple. So our foundation is nervous system regulation. Right on top of that is relationship work. We teach intro to tantra, nothing outside of the box too much. We teach eye gazing. We teach imago dialogue, nonviolent communication. We give you scripts and we have you sit down and hopefully laugh a lot, because no one does this well. We practice difficult conversations. We have an entire week on difficult conversations. We just ran it last week for our program, and it's amazing. Dave, one of our leaders, teaches it, and basically we have all of these couples there. And then if people are willing to bring a problem, because we're a group based, so it's more than one couple, we're a group. So if someone's willing to bring a problem, we will walk through it with them. It's an opportunity, because we only can do one or two in that class, but it's also a big vulnerability. And if not, we practice, and we have a couple that we've already scripted and we've already done, and we work really hard on that connection space. So part of that is being together in community with our communication styles and our intro to tantra, and part of it is being separate by showing each individual group how you can love each other better.
You used the word nonviolent with
Communication.
communication. And so recently I've heard someone talk about sex being violent, like the way that people talk about sex and the way that people have sex now today is violent. I was like, oh, that just sounds awful, but I guess it might be true based on the examples that they gave in that frame. But I've never heard anybody say nonviolent communication. Can you share a little
Yeah.
bit of that with the listeners?
Yes. And then I'd like to talk about the sex part too, if you're open to that, because
For
I
sure.
think that I have an idea for that too. Nonviolent communication is actually a type of communication established by Marshall Rosenberg. So it's actually called NVC, nonviolent communication, and it's about how we can communicate with each other so as to not instigate a response in someone, in our partner, or whoever we are speaking with, that would be negative. So both nonviolent communication and imago dialogue is basically to find a way to have a conversation that is going to be uncomfortable or difficult, and at that point in time, find a way to not trigger each other in that space. Because if I'm upset with my partner for some reason, and I want to sit down immediately, if I say, I want to talk to you about something, immediately we're up like, what is it? What did I do now? Right? What did I do now? And that is, we're eradicating that. It's not, what did I do now? It's, okay, the person I love is hurting in some way. And because I love them, I want to hear them clearly, because I don't want them hurting, because we are a team. So if they're hurting, I'm hurting. It doesn't mean I've done something. It doesn't mean she's pointing a finger or he's pointing a finger. I need to hear them out and see where they are and understand why, because I love them. So that's what we're teaching in those aspects.
I think so many people are, when they think about communication, they just want to get stuff out. And so, is it like phrases that you use to neutralize it so that it's not triggering? Or give me some more, because I'm absolutely fascinated at this point.
I'm going to be very, very honest. I am not the expert here. And every time we have these, I will happily do this, but every time we have these conversations, I'm so excited to be present when they teach this class because I learn something every time. And I'm the first person to say, I'm not very good at this. I'm divorced now. My ex-husband, when I found NVC a long time ago, maybe 2017 or so. Yeah, so 7 6 7 years ago. I would try to have these conversations, and he was so frustrated with me because I would speak slowly. And he's like, just spit it out. And I was like, I'm trying to find the right words. So we have to, first of all, know we're in practice. And part of it is understanding that I told you. Understand that I want to know what you, as my partner, has on your mind and your heart. Because I love you and I don't want you suffering. And I definitely don't want you suffering at my hand or the perception of it being at my hand. So frequently what we do with imago dialogue, they're not interchangeable exactly, they're close. But frequently what it is, one person is going to say, I need to speak with you about something that's been on my heart. And it's helpful if you tell your partner what that's about, the conversation we had on Friday. Are you open? Are you open to having that conversation? Now, the partner has to be able to check in with their body. So, this is somatic. Feel in your body, feel in your mind, in your breath. Are you really open? Okay. Because if you are, yes. But if you just walked in the door from work and you say, babe, I hear you. I really need about a half hour of downtime so that I can get myself set and get myself right to hear you well. Is that okay with you? And if they say yes, set a time. Okay, so let's talk at 7 p.m. Okay. So it's not about a half hour and 35 minutes have gone on and now I'm up in arms because you're 5 minutes late. It's we're setting a time, setting a realistic time, both of you agree, and you sit down and you keep that promise of that time. So if it's not today, if it's tomorrow, if it's I've got so much to do and I have to work till midnight, can we do this over breakfast tomorrow? I've got a deadline. Yes. If it can't wait, that's a different conversation, but hopefully it can. Then, when you sit down and have that conversation is completely to allow that person who has the grievance to let that information out to you. It's not for a rebuttal. It's not for, one thing I like to say is excuses are not apologies. Excuses are not apologies. So, if I'm going to hear you because clearly something I said hurt your feelings, you know what that means? Something I said hurt your feelings. Really, and it came from me. So it might be because that's something that your mother used to say to you, or it might be because of the timing of the day, or you had just gotten out of an argument with somebody else. It could be for so many reasons, but there was a piece that is mine. So I need to own that piece. So if you're going to sit down with me and say, this is where I'm coming from, this is what we do, I'm going to say, Jerome, when we were talking about you wanted to go out with some friends on Saturday night, and I haven't seen you for a week and a half, and I really wanted to spend some time with you. Oh, this is resonating with you. Yeah, I really wanted to spend some time with you, and it just really hurt my feelings that you weren't thinking of me first, and was really sad about that. And so I was hoping that you and I could have a conversation about that. Because I would like to think that you think of me first before you think of your friends when we're spending so much time together, or we're living together, and all we're doing is working all the time. And I just thought you'd want to spend time with me as opposed to your friends.
Oh, Jess.
Yeah. And this is what you say. Okay, so I'm going to help you. And so your response is, so what I'm hearing is, and you reflect back to me what you heard. Yeah, you don't have to do it, but do you want to? You can if you.
Oh, Jess. What I heard you saying is you wanted to spend time with me. You didn't think I put you first because I made plans with other people. I guess I should have asked you do you had a desire to spend time or made plans for us? Would that have been better?
See, and that's look how beautiful that was. And even before even saying all of that, you could say you reflected back and you don't even have to give at that point a suggestion of asking. And also don't offer unless it's something you could change. Okay?
So
Because
it's past. So if it's already happened, then you can't change what's already happened. So,
in the future, like if
okay.
you're like, oh, in the future, can you though? So before we get there, what I would want you to do is say, did I get that right?
Did I get that
And
right?
yes, you did. And then you say, is there more?
Is there more?
No, I think everything, just for time's sake, there isn't any more. But usually there's something more there, right? But it can be just that. And then it can be, then you could say, maybe I should have asked you first, but only if, and this is a soul searching piece for you, only if that's something that you actually would do, is would you be able to consider asking first? Or, and if not, then don't offer that, because that'll be a letdown for next week's conversation. You know, so we really have to honor ourselves and look into that and say, well, I really wanted to spend this time with my friends, but maybe what we could do, because there's a special event with my best friend, he's got this thing going on and I wanted to go. Maybe what we could do is start planning the weekend in advance. Like, what do we have next weekend? And making sure we prioritize some time together on the weekend, even if it's not during that time, so that we make sure we always have a date time every weekend, since we're living life the rest of the time. We're just in the grind of it. We're work, we're who's doing what, who's walking the dog, and who's doing the dishes. So it's that kind of a conversation, and you don't get to say your part until it's all complete. And then usually we use the words, are you complete? Yes, I'm complete. So those are some of those words. And then if you had something like that, you felt like it was, if you felt you had reasoning behind whatever, even if it's not this, but if you had reasoning behind it. But I love, Jerome, that you didn't give any excuse like, well, he only has this once a year, this event, and none of that, because that doesn't help anything. That makes me see, not feel seen or validated. So that's an example of how those communication processes can go.
I think so. It's fascinating that you're working on the relationship when most people are coming to you because they feel like they have a fertility problem.
I would love for you to go to our website and just listen to, we have a video testimonial right up there, and it's one of the husbands saying, I had no idea that this was going to help me be a better manager at work. So one of our other mottos is having the baby is the easy part. If you can't get this stuff straight, our success rates are 77 to 80%. Like, we're really, really successful as what at what we do. And we are very aligned with the people that come in, and we ask them all the right questions to make sure we're a good fit for each other. And so once they come in, then we know that this is really about change at such a base level. We're changing, we're getting your stress state low. We're helping you with a, and part of that is a loving relationship at home. And if you think fighting about the dishes before children come along is going to be an issue, wait till after they're here. Once they're here, who's doing what is a thing. So we want to help people get established in that. And when we have that powerful relationship, you can do anything together. You can do the nutrition together. You can cook together or not, but you know what you're doing. You're doing it as a team. And that team, actually, that community, has been proven to be anti-inflammatory and has been proven to bring stress level down, like cortisol level down. So that also improves fertility. So everything we do is actually improving fertility, but it's also improving all global health for your body. It's improving your relationship with your partner. And then you start speaking about this with your friends and family, because you won't tolerate misbehavior from your brothers, your sisters, your parents, your You won't, and they're going to see what you're doing, and you're going to educate them. We want a ripple effect to be able to change the world in this way.
I'm still baffled. How did you know that you had to do more than just deal with the baby making part?
Oh,
Because
I am, yeah, I'm the biggest nerd on the planet, and all I do is learn things that can improve things. I love it so much. And so we know in functional medicine, and when it comes to functional coaching, so our business is more of a coaching model, because we're teaching you how to do those things that need to change. And there are five basics. Your nutrition needs to change. Your stress management has to change. And I hate to use the word change, but what are we addressing? Stress, nutrition, exercise. You might be over-exercising or under-exercising. Sleep, because sleep patterns and sleep quality impact sex hormones and fertility hormones. And relationships. So those are the five things, at least those first four. Without relationships, most look at, but we added relationships because we are a fertility program and we want couples to stay together. I had infertility. I have twins from assistance, not functional medicine, and I'm divorced. Don't do what I did. Don't do what I did. And so, but now I love what we're doing and watching how much we're building upon. What's so interesting is when I find out any little aspect, like the community aspect and the decreased inflammation aspect of just having community is so impactful. If you look at blue zones where people live to over 100 years of age, community, 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 it is so important and so impactful. And we've lost that in this country. And we lose it more and more every day simply with our virtual world and our not living with our extended families. And that's okay. But then we have to find a way to compensate for it. And we aren't noticing we have a slippery slope of going from health to non-health. And a little bit happens at a time. We get too busy because we are stressed. We need to pay the bills because we bought this big house. So then we need to work later. So we need to eat food that isn't prepared by us, which isn't as healthy for us because we have to work more. And our stress, see, all of those aspects. So we have to, aspects are crazy. So then we have to stay up till midnight, like we said, because I have a deadline. But I have to wake up at 5 and I don't get to exercise because I've got to get back to work and I'm on a conference call with China. So I need to make sure I'm doing that at 4 in the morning. So we're doing all of this because we're expected, and this is normal for us now. So we're trying to help people restructure normal.
I watch so many people get lost in the sauce and then they want a vacation. And it's my belief that you build a life that you don't need a vacation from. So this work is fascinating. I think it's making a real impact. And because you took your leap, we didn't talk about this, and I want to briefly. So there's a really cool book called The Surrender Experiment by Michael Singer, if I remember correctly. And I believe you read that book, and I
I did.
think it had a pretty big impact on your life. And so, if you would, can you talk about surrender and what difference it's made for you?
Yeah, and I'll tell you, I read the book because a whole lot of people in my life asked me if I had, and I hadn't yet, because it's how I already lived my life. So it was validation to how I live my life, reading the Surrender Experiment, and I strongly recommend it. It is basically Michael Singer's journey through life. And what he did was he surrendered to the circumstances around him. And so this is how I've lived my life a lot. I am a big meditation person. I am a big believer in resonant frequency and quantum physics and quantum mechanics. So basically, I think that it's really important to keep that stress management under control and to elevate ourselves in the space of curiosity and growth. So when you do that and you start looking at the world with curiosity, doors, and you talk to people. I talk to everyone. You never know what, that's how I started, by talking to everyone before I knew what I was doing. This is what I'm doing. It's what I want to do. And I was just shouting it from the rooftops with zero shame, guilt, or fear, because I just had to figure out something and I wasn't getting anywhere, anywhere. I wasn't getting anywhere. Then people start listening and then they start making suggestions and then you follow those suggestions. So I think that is an easy start when it comes to the idea of surrender experiment. But what happens with surrender experiment is you basically keep your eyes open and you walk through every open door that feels like a direction you should go. If it brings you joy and opportunity in that feeling sense for yourself, walk through that open door. There will be a lot of them. Sometimes you have to say no and you can choose, but the whole idea of surrender experiment is to walk through all of them. I walk through all of them. If a door slams shut, I say thank you. That's not the direction I was supposed to go. And I also say thank you for not wasting my time. Say no quickly, right? We all heard this, say make it a yes or a no, not a maybe. Right. So if we can make it a yes or a no, is great. So if a door slams shut, then we go from there. So, okay. So would you like an example? Last September, I went to a conference and it was, they had an offer for pitch competition. And I thought, oh, no big deal. I'll apply because I've won a pitch competition and a lot of people in that community, they haven't done incubator work and everything. So I thought, shoo-in. I didn't get accepted the pitch competition. And I was like, oh, nothing breaks my heart. Like, nothing breaks my heart. It's just another thing. So, but that door closed. And I thought, well, that, okay. I thought that was strange because I was pretty sure I was a shoo-in for that. So, but I was still going to the conference, and they did this rapid fire, like speed dating round of introduce yourself and your company during this time at before the conference, 2 weeks before the conference. So I did mine, and the woman who was running it happened to pop into my room, my little breakout room, when I gave my little spiel about my company. And she said, "Jessica, you know your shit." And I said, "Thank you." And she said, "I'd like to offer for you to come to my affiliate program course. It's the day before if you're willing to fly in early, because I'm in Michigan, they were in Arizona, and you can be my guest." So I had 2 weeks. I said, "Thank you so much. I accepted it free, right? No ticket to purchase. I'm going as her guest. She runs the program. Okay. I have 2 weeks. I build an affiliate program in 2 weeks," because basically it was to go and trade with other affiliates. And so I built an affiliate program in 2 weeks. I went there. I signed up people in my affiliate program. So I was brand new to affiliate work. Met a woman there whose name is Betsy Greenleaf, who's a urogynecologist, who basically we connected. I went on her summit and then her sexual dysfunction summit. And then she introduced me to a number of other people, but one of which is just put us at the top of their funnel for a referral network for fertility that is basically an AI-driven component from the it's like MIT Harvard connection, and they have an AI company that they're partnering with that just launched. So the door closed for the pitch competition. Thank goodness, because I would have spent those 2 weeks preparing for a pitch competition. If she had said, "Come be an affiliate, part of this affiliate program," I wouldn't have had the time to build an affiliate program. So here was the thing. The door closed on the pitch competition where I didn't even know what my ask would have been. I'm like, what would I didn't even know my ask for that pitch. It was just going and being on a stage, which I've done and I could do again, but it just didn't have any real resonance. But I'm walking through every open door. That one closed. Look what opened. So I highly recommend the surrender experiment.
Well, and it's a game changer, although you didn't speak about revenue. The fact that you have that visibility is visibility that you wouldn't have had any other way. And being the best kept secret is a disaster for every early entrepreneur. And your ability to spend your time going through the steps of creating something prior to getting to the place where you needed to have it, that level of preparedness is magic. It is the magic that we all want to have, because if we aren't prepared for an opportunity when it arises, then we miss the opportunity, right? And success is preparedness and opportunity meeting. So this is so good. I'm so glad you decided to spend some time with us on the Dreamcatchers podcast. I got a lot from it, which then I know our listeners will get a ton from it. If they want to learn more about what you guys are doing at your clinic, where should they go?
So we're at denovofertility.com. So it's DENOVO fertility.com. That's our website. We're on all social media platforms. Facebook is Denovo Fertility Community. Instagram is Denovo underscore fertility. And then you can always email us at hello@denovofertility.com if you wanted to speak with us or learn about our programs. But there's information on our website itself as well.
Jessica, you are a dream catcher, my dear. Thank you so much for joining me on the podcast. To our listeners, your dreams should be real. We'll catch you on the next episode.
Thank you for joining the tribe today. We would love to hear from you. Please don't forget to rate, like, and share. Perhaps someone you know could benefit from what we've discussed. Until the next time, remember that your dreams should be real.